Turn to Mark's Gospel. Mark's Gospel, and we have reached chapter 13 and verse 24, and you remember then how this whole portion of Mark's Gospel really is in response to a question which the disciples have asked back in verse 4. Peter and James and John and Andrew ask Jesus privately, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished?" And the "these things" that they're referring to there is itself in response to what Jesus has said back in verse 2. "Do you see these great buildings?" referring to the temple. "There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." So the disciples are asking the question, when will this temple be destroyed? And Jesus is answering that question in this passage. And so now we've reached verse 24. And he has just spoken about the great tribulation and the various events which will lead up to the destruction of the temple and the invasion of Jerusalem. And now he says in verse 24, "But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken, and then they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send out his angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." Well, if you were to produce this evening a list of 10 days which changed the world, I wonder what you would put on that list. It might be the day that penicillin was discovered. It might be the day that Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the castle door in Wittenberg. It might be the day that the first atomic bomb was dropped over the people of Japan. And as Christians, we often have our own list of days that changed the world, don't we? The day that sin entered the world, the day that Jesus, the Messiah, was born, the day that his tomb was found to be empty. Well, this evening I want to add another day to that list. And the date that I want to add to that list, according to our Western dating system, is Saturday the 2nd of August, AD 70, just over 1,952 years ago. It's the day, of course, that the temple in Jerusalem was ransacked by the Roman armies and demolished. And that's the event which Jesus has been speaking of, as I said a moment ago, in this chapter. And that's the event he now describes, even with this very dramatic language, in verses 24 to 27. You might struggle to believe that. These verses seem to be speaking of something much grander than that. Skies being darkened, the Son of Man appearing on the clouds, the angels being involved in gathering people. Surely this is about the very end of the world, you think? Well, actually, no, I don't think so. I agree with Dan and I agree with Alan Thomas in this verdict. I don't think this is about the end of the world. And I think The reason we perhaps struggle to believe that verses 24 to 27 here are about AD 70 is because actually we have failed to understand just how grand an event that was. We are the ones who have underestimated just how much that event changed the world and just how prominent it was in the thinking of Jesus. And so this evening then, I just want to take that date, AD 70, I want to put it on the table, so to speak, to put it under the microscope, and I want us to study it, and I want us to see what Jesus has to say about it in this passage. And in particular, I want us to see three things that Jesus says will take place at that moment in history. And the first is this: a dramatic condemnation. A dramatic condemnation. We start with verses 24 and 25. Jesus says, "But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken." What's Jesus doing there? Well, Jesus is using typical Old Testament imagery. Imagery used in the Old Testament to convey the drama and the doom of God's judgment on his people, usually through an enemy invasion. Amos chapter 8, verse 9, "And on that day, declares the Lord God, I will make the sun go down at noon and darken the earth in broad daylight." Amos is speaking there about God's judgment on Israel through the Assyrians. Isaiah 13:10, "For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising and the moon will not shed its light." That's how Isaiah describes God's judgment on Judah through the Babylonians. And in Ezekiel, we read a moment ago, and we'll come back to that passage in a little while, we see that same language, the sun, the moon being darkened, referring there to God's judgment on Egypt, also through the Babylonian armies. And so what's Jesus doing here in these verses? Well, he's employing this same prophetic language of judgment on Israel, but now not with regard to the Assyrians or Babylonians, but this time it's God's condemnation of Israel through the Romans. Israel, he's saying, is running headlong into a place of deepest darkness and despair, which even the sun and the moon will be unable to penetrate. It will be as if the lights of their world have been snuffed out. What will happen exactly? Well, in AD 66, the Jews will revolt against the Romans, and in response to that revolt, Emperor Nero will send in the troops, and in AD 70 then, General Titus will besiege Jerusalem with 60,000 Roman soldiers. He will cut off their food and water supply for 5 months. He will forbid anyone from leaving while allowing people to enter the city. And finally then, he will breach the wall, he will ransack the temple, he will burn it down and brutally massacre the remaining population. Let me just read a passage describing this, written by the Jewish historian Josephus. This is what Josephus is writing. He's involved in these events, and he describes it in this way. He says, "As the legions charged in, neither persuasion nor threat could check their impetuosity. Passion alone was in command. Crowded together around the entrances, many were trampled by their friends. Many fell among the still hot and smoking ruins of the colonnades and died as miserably as the defeated. As they neared the sanctuary, they pretended not even to hear Caesar's command and urged the men in front to throw in more firebrands. The partisans were no longer in a position to help. Everywhere was slaughter and flight. Most of the victims were peaceful citizens, weak and unarmed, butchered wherever they were caught. Round the altar, heaps of corpses grew higher and higher, while down the sanctuary steps poured a river of blood, and the bodies of those killed at the top slithered to the bottom." That's God's condemnation on Israel in AD 70. And it's just around the corner. of this passage being pronounced by Jesus. And why did this happen? Why are the people of God punished in this way? Well, they're punished for the same reason that they've always been punished, for their national sin, particularly for the hypocrisy Jesus had condemned and condemns throughout this book, for being that brood of vipers, for being a fruitless fig tree, as we saw back in chapter 11, for allowing the temple, the house of prayer, to become a den of thieves, for spurning again and again and again God's blessings, for shedding the blood of the prophets, for resisting and killing men like John, and for one more thing, flip back to chapter 12, and you remember in chapter 12 we have that parable of the tenants of the vineyard, Jesus uses to refer to the religious leaders of his day in the parable. And what do they do in the parable? They kill all those servants that the owner of the vineyard sends to them. And he's referring there to the prophets, of course, who are killed by the Jews. And then finally, the owner sends his own son to the vineyard. And who is Jesus referring to there? Well, of course, he's referring to none other than Jesus himself. And what happens? Chapter 12, verse 8. And they took him, that's the son, and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. And Jesus' point is that the religious leaders won't get away with that kind of thing. Verse 9, what will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the tenants and give the vineyard to others. See, it couldn't be clearer, could it? The climax of Israel's sin is their murder of God's son. And AD 70 then tells you that you don't kill God's son and get away with it. All of those scribes, those chief priests plotting to kill Christ, just like they had the other prophets, they've got another thing coming. In a few years from now, their whole world, their homes, their livelihoods, their religious orders, their precious temple, which they thought was so indestructible, all of that will come crumbling down, the powers will be shaken, the lights will go out. And Jesus then employs dramatic Old Testament imagery to describe that event, just as the prophets before him had. So what do we do with that? What difference does AD 70 make to us? Do we treat this simply as a cautionary tale, not to provoke God to anger? Well, yes, it is a cautionary tale, isn't it? But it's a cautionary tale for this reason. AD 70, bad though it was, is not the end of the story here. You see, when the prophets talk about God's judgment bringing darkness, yes, they are usually talking about particular instances, moments in history. But on other occasions, they seem to have something much bigger in view than that. The prophets speak not only of local historical judgments, but also of a coming universal judgment. Not only the condemnation of this nation or that nation, but all nations, all proud human powers. And not just the condemnation of nations, but of the false gods, the false religions of those nations. And allow me just a few moments to digress on that particular point, on the fact that one day the prophets tell us God will condemn the spiritual counterparts, so to speak, the satanic overlords of the nations themselves. We see it in Isaiah chapter 24. You don't need to turn there, but in that chapter, we do see not a local judgment, but we see the prophet speaking of a worldwide judgment. And we read there that God will punish the powers in the heavens above and the kings on the earth below. Well, what's meant there by God punishing the powers of the heavens above? Well, in that chapter, in verse 23, we read this. The moon will be dismayed, the sun ashamed. See, here, the attack on the sun and the moon is really getting at the gods that they represent. When God judges the world, he will judge not only kings and nations, but also their false gods. All of the deceptive powers of Satan will come under judgment. We see a similar thing in Ezekiel, the passage that we read earlier on. You might want to turn back there if you've got something in that passage, but if it's too hard to find, don't worry about it. But back in chapter 32 of Ezekiel, we saw there how Ezekiel referred to Pharaoh like a dragon, or a crocodile, we could say. And he goes on to say, both in 29 and 32, that the Lord will drag up out of the Nile and destroy that crocodile. And what are we seeing in that passage then? Well, we're seeing God's judgment on Pharaoh through the Babylonians, but surely we're also seeing there God's judgment on someone else, on an Egyptian god, specifically, I think, Sebek, the crocodile god, who was thought to give Pharaoh his power. God says to that crocodile, that dragon, in verse 6 of 32, "I will drench the land, even to the mountains, with your flowing blood." That's Sebek, the false god, the deception of Satan, being judged on that day. But then notice how Ezekiel goes on in that passage. In verse 27, he changes the analogy, and he says to Pharaoh, "When I blot you out, I will cover the heavens and make their stars dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give its light. All the bright lights of heaven I will make dark over you and put darkness on your land." So now the analogy's changed. Pharaoh is blotted out. What are we seeing there? Well, again, I think we are seeing God condemning another Egyptian god, another Egyptian deity. This time I think it's Re, the sun god, who was also associated with Pharaoh, was a very important god in Egyptian religion. In fact, at Bible times, both Sebek and Re were often merged together into a single god, Sebek Re, who was sort of a crocodile with the head of a falcon. And so God then, he is judging the Egyptian gods in that passage. By the way, that the end of chapter 32 of Ezekiel there, I think, reminds us quite deliberately of God's plagues upon Egypt in Exodus. One of the plagues turned the Nile into flowing blood, so to speak, as we see that mention of blood in verse 6. But another plague, of course, put darkness over the land. The language is almost the same. God's condemnation, not just of Egypt, but of Egypt's gods. Babylon is God's weapon then, and through Babylon he exposes the weakness, the powerlessness of Egypt's false gods. But of course, in the last analysis, not even Babylon gets to escape the final judgment. In Isaiah chapter 14, Babylon there is described as the day star, or the son of dawn. And again, that seems to be a reference to some figure from mythology, another false god or angel. And Isaiah describes that star then rising haughtily above the others and then falling down into the dark grave of Sheol. And he's greeted there by the other shades, the ghosts of the nations. Very much like Jesus' words, the stars will be falling from heaven and the powers will be shaken. And so I'm simply holding all of this out to you then this evening, not just as an interesting point of speculation, but as a bare fact. The prophets tell us that one day all nations, all religions, all beings, whether in earth or in heaven, will come to judgment. That is what we're told. I don't get a kick out of saying that. I find it quite difficult to say that from time to time, but it is the truth. Mike Davison reminded us on Wednesday, didn't he, that we're surrounded by people in this world, in this neighbourhood, who do not realise the danger that they're in. Well, perhaps you're one of those people this evening, and perhaps what we've said there of judgment disturbs you a little bit. And I want to speak to you now. I appreciate that it would be very tempting for you right now and very easy for you to dismiss everything that I've been saying. All you have to do is step outside of this building into the car park and get that fresh air in your face, and suddenly all of these warnings of judgment just seem ridiculous, don't they? They just blow away on the wind. Or you walk down the hustle and bustle of Northumberland Street and suddenly talk of God's judgment just seems so remote there, doesn't it? Everything there looks so permanent and stable and robust, and you see all these other people and all these other religions and all of these other groups doing all of their different things, all of these ideas floating out there, and you think, well, surely the Bible, and it's just one of many different options. Jesus is just another teacher. The Bible's just another book. I've got nothing to be afraid of. Judgment is just a silly idea. Well, I strongly advise you not to take that approach and not to brush this off. the prophets say that judgment is coming. And they say that for those who do not listen to that warning, it will be a day of darkness. The gods, so to speak, will be judged on that day. Every false evil power, whether political or religious or demonic, will be snuffed out like a candle. Every other false belief system, every other possible philosophy or religion which stands against the truths of the Bible will be shown to be silly and ridiculous. And all of those who have been relying on those things will have nothing left in them but darkness. And if you're one of those people, then you need a shelter. You need a light for that day. And only Jesus can offer you that light. You know, perhaps for 40-odd years after Jesus spoke these prophecies, you could hope that nothing would really come of these words. But then one day, AD 70 breaks onto the scene, and you realize that you shouldn't have shaken off those warnings after all. So we're seeing here a dramatic condemnation in this passage. That's my first point. It's slightly longer than my next points. The second thing I want us to see here in our passage this evening is a public coronation. A public coronation. Now, Mark says that the Son of Man will come on the clouds. Verse 26, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. Now, what is Jesus referring to there? Well, perhaps instantly we think of Jesus' second coming at the end of history. And there are places in the Bible which speak about that coming at the very end of history in that way. When the disciples are seeing Jesus ascending, the angels next to them say to them, this Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven. Jesus will come on the clouds. He will return again. That's truth. That's biblical. But that doesn't seem to be what is in view in chapter 13 and verse 26. You see, here in this chapter, we only have to look ahead to verse 30 to see that Jesus is referring to something which is going to be taking place fairly soon. In the space of a generation indeed. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. And this isn't the first time, in fact, that Jesus has spoken about this coming on the clouds with reference to his own generation. Back in Mark chapter 8, at the very end of that chapter, Jesus says, for whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. And he said to them, truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power. So this coming of the Son of Man, this kingdom coming in power, is something that will be witnessed by Jesus' contemporaries. So what then is this coming? Well, as we've said on several other occasions going through this gospel, Jesus is clearly referring to another Old Testament prophecy, to Daniel chapter 7. And what do we see in Daniel chapter 7? I'm sorry that we're jumping around scripture quite a lot this evening. You don't need to turn there. I'm not going to read from it. But Daniel chapter 7, we see in that chapter the Son of Man coming on the clouds, one like the Son of Man, coming where exactly? Coming to the Ancient of Days, to God, to his Father. And then he is given, in that chapter, a dominion, and he's given a kingdom, which in contrast to all the other earthly kingdoms, is eternal and will not pass away. We could call Daniel 7, then, a heavenly coronation service for the Son of Man. And this is what Jesus is talking about here, I think. So then, are there any events which take place in the space of Jesus' generation that bear any resemblance to this dramatic coronation? Well, there is one in particular, isn't there? We've just mentioned it. Jesus' ascension. Jesus coming on the clouds into the presence of the Ancient of Days, his Father. And remember what Jesus tells his disciples before he ascends? He says to them that every authority has been given to him on heaven and earth. So again, that's Daniel 7 language. He's making that point, and then he ascends into heaven. And so in short then, I'm saying that at the ascension, the victorious, resurrected Jesus takes his throne and is invested with power and authority over the nations, and that it's there then that of all the places we get to see our clearest glimpse on that coronation service for the Son of Man. However, there is something which is a bit out of place here, isn't there? Because that ascension was a relatively private affair. It was just the disciples who witnessed it and a few angels, at least on earth. But in Mark 13, Jesus gives the impression that this coming of the Son of Man is something that people will see, many people will see, seems to be the point. So how do we fit that together? Well, I think that's where AD 70 comes back into the picture. Let me put it to you like this. AD 70 is the moment where the power of Jesus, the authority, the new kingship of Jesus is there for everyone to see in history, clearly shining in the skies. Now, why do I say that? Well, something tremendous is taking place on that date. That fruitless fig tree, which was the analogy for the temple that we referred to back in chapter 11, that old corrupted temple system, so to speak, has withered in accordance with the curse that Jesus put over it. And that's not just a moment of grief for the tree then, it's a sign of the power, the kingdom, the newly established dominion of the one who cursed it. Jesus went into that temple and he threw down those tables and he cursed that system. And just as the curse he put on the fig tree came to fruition, or not fruition as the case may be, the tree was withered, the same happens with the temple in AD 70. The Son of Man was rejected, was mocked, was crucified, was killed, just as he predicted. But that same Son of Man claimed that after 3 days he would rise. He claimed that he was bringing a kingdom. He claimed indeed, really, that he was the king. And if ever you wanted proof that those words were not spoken in vain, that death did not defeat Jesus, but that he really did rise, the tomb really was empty, he really did ascend, he really did take his throne, and he really did bring into existence a new order, a new kingdom, a new world, AD 70 is the historical moment you're looking for. It stands as a great symbol in the skies of what was happening in the heavenly sphere. One earthly temple falls, and in that moment, what do we see? Well, we see the stone that the builders have rejected being hurled into the side of that temple, so to speak, destroying it and becoming the chief cornerstone of a new heavenly temple in its place. One earthly kingdom falls, and what do we see in that fall? Well, we see the heavenly kingdom of the Son of Man now coming in power and glory to replace it. Jesus is saying that in that moment, every Jew will be forced to see that their old order and temple and institutions and religious parties and all of the political prowess which they possessed before then is now mere dust around the feet of the risen Son of Man whom they rejected. And that while the kingdom of Jerusalem, with its wicked Herod and its hypocritical scribes and its murderous Pharisees, just fades away, the kingdom of Christ at the same moment advances across the world, commanded from the skies by the Son of Man. That's the message then that AD 70 communicates. It's a symbol, it sort of signifies that that has happened, that there is a new king on the block. And all I just want to do this evening then is just lift our heads to the skies, so to speak, and see that this king truly does reign. He truly does have dominion over us. You know, when we sing those words, "Rejoice, the Lord is King," or "Jesus shall reign where'er the sun," or something like that, we're not just stating or putting our faith in a kind of timeless truth which is sort of out of sight and out of reach. You know, sort of like Jesus is King and it's always been like that, and I can't see it right now, but I will one day, and that's as far as I can get. Now, obviously there's some truth in that, but that's not the full picture. No, when we say, "Rejoice, the Lord is King," we're singing about a recent triumph. We're singing about good, fresh news, about a development which has taken place in the sphere of history. The Son of Man has finally won the battle and has defeated death and has risen into life and has ascended into heaven and has taken the throne and has been given the dominion. He is King now, and this is news which is fresh off the press. And while the events of AD 70 are appalling, at the same time, we are seeing there a new era beginning. We are seeing the coronation of the Son of Man made public. He truly is powerful. He truly is King. And in that, then, we should celebrate. There should be a sense of newness to the world in which we live. The world should look like a new place to us. And while it's not true that the Lord has returned again, and yes, injustice and sin still remain, nevertheless, he has now sat down on that throne and no obstacle lies in his way now, and not an enemy stands in his path. The coronation has taken place. The Lord is King, and nobody can challenge that anymore. So, we've seen in this passage then a condemnation, and we've seen a coronation. I think these words are a little bit too similar for memory today, but even still, a condemnation, a coronation, and then finally, I want us to see a congregation, or an epic congregation. Perhaps one of the striking things about Jesus' prophecy here is that he combines both very negative and very positive strands of Old Testament scripture. And at first sight, that might seem like a contradiction. So on the one hand, we see this sort of imagery of disaster, the darkening of the sun and the moon. And we said it reminds us of the ways that the prophets spoke about an enemy invasion. And that's a very bleak strand of prophecy. It's very negative. And what we might expect then is Jesus would now quote a passage about the Babylonian exile, a text like Hosea chapter 9, verse 17. My God will reject them because they have not obeyed him. They will be wanderers among the nations. Or a text like Deuteronomy 4:27, the Lord will scatter you among the peoples. Or Zechariah 2:6, I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heavens, declares the Lord. Prophecies about the scattering of God's people. And that would have made perfect sense historically, because if anything, AD 70 was a time of scattering. It was a watershed moment in the Jewish diaspora. It was the case that many Jews were already living outside of Palestine, probably millions at this point in history, but nevertheless, after AD 70, you just see this scattering of Jews across the globe, growing and growing, and the number of Jews in Palestine shrinking and shrinking. So it was a scattering, and that would have been a totally appropriate way for Jesus to talk about it, scattering on the four winds of heaven. But that's not what we see in this passage. Instead, Jesus takes that verse, I think, from Zechariah, and he reverses it. In verse 27, he now talks not about a scattering, but a gathering his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. In other words, Jesus is prophesying a return from exile. And in doing that, then, he's tapping into a very positive strand of Old Testament prophecy. The restoration, the regrouping of Israel. Texts like Isaiah 43, 5-6. I will bring your offspring from the east, and from the west I will gather you. I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the ends of the earth. Or Psalm 107, the redeemed are gathered in from the lands, from the east and from the west, from the north and from the south. Or Psalm 147, the Lord builds up Jerusalem, not destroys it, he builds up Jerusalem, he gathers the outcasts of Israel. These prophecies, which Jesus is now alluding to, about the restoration, the regrouping of Israel, the growing congregation of God's people. So why is he doing that? What's he saying here? Well, this is what it is, I think. Jesus has already told us what would happen to the kingdom of Israel. Judgment is coming. There will be a scattering. But now, however, he wants to talk to us about what will happen in the realm of the kingdom of the Son of Man while AD 70 is taking place. And his point then is this, that in the Son of Man's kingdom, in this new kingdom, we finally see all of those prophecies of restoration and regrouping now fulfilled. The fall of the old kingdom meant more dissolution, more dispersion, more diaspora, but for the Son of Man's kingdom, there will be an ingathering, a growing congregation. While one is scattered, another grows. And if we're looking for an event in history which captures that moment historically, well, surely the moment is Pentecost, isn't it? Again, taking place in the first century in the space of a generation. Pentecost is the beginning of this new congregation where Jews from all over the world are gathered together in one place. Parthians, Medes, Elamites, Mesopotamians, Judeans, Cappadocians, people from Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, Libya, Rome, Cretans and Arabians. And Peter preaches to all of those people and thousands are converted and we see a dramatic homecoming into the kingdom of the Son of Man. But even there, Pentecost is just the beginning of this process, isn't it? Throughout the first century, the church grows and grows and grows. And for that reason then, I expect for many Jews, there was a deep conflict in their hearts as they looked upon AD 70. And the destruction of Jerusalem. Because they were aware that while one part of their national identity was sort of collapsing before their eyes, and that was a tragedy, they had another national identity, which was swelling with pride and amazement as the true kingdom of God spread throughout the world, as the elect were gathered into one growing congregation, the church. Historians reckon that before AD 70, there may have been up to 400,000 converted Jews. And by the end of that century, perhaps a million. It was an epic congregation. And of course, it didn't stop with the Jews. Jesus speaks of the gathering of the elect here, the chosen ones. What does he... And ultimately then, Jesus, I think, is speaking here about an open-ended event where both Jews and Gentiles, all the way through history, are gathered together into one congregation. I know time's going by, but I just want to end by thinking about this one thing. Consider here how God gathers his elect in this passage. It says in verse 27, he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds. And perhaps you are a little bit alarmed by that. I mean, you think to yourself, well, angels, surely this bit is about the second coming. This is about the end of history. This is far too dramatic. This hasn't been fulfilled in our own time. But once again, I think we probably think that because we don't appreciate just how dramatic the growth of the church actually is and was. I mean, both in the days of the apostles and in our day. Actually, in the book of Acts, you see angels quite a lot. They're with the disciples at the ascension at the beginning. They rescue the apostles from prison in chapter 5. They direct Philip to the Ethiopian eunuch in chapter 8. They direct Cornelius to the gospel in chapter 10. Where are the angels in the first century? Well, they're not guarding the walls of Jerusalem. They're out there in the world, gathering people, helping to grow the church, defending the church in Europe and Africa and all across the world. In those first few years, the angels are dramatically gathering the elect and advancing the gospel just as Jesus predicts. And this is the point that I want to end in. I don't think that has changed. There still are myriads and myriads of angels, aren't there? They haven't gone anywhere. Those angels haven't suddenly become idle. They're not now kicking their feet looking for things to do. No, there's a big project on. The gathering of the elect, the growth of the church, the protection of the church, that is still happening. And in the words of Hebrews 1:14 then, are they not all ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? And so I'll end just by saying this, that just let that truth inject a little bit of epicness, a bit more amazement, a bit of wonder into how you view the church. I'm not saying you'll ever meet an angel. I'm not saying you'll ever know how they serve you. I expect that when you came to Christ, you had absolutely no consciousness of the involvement of angels in that. And I expect, as Alan, I'm sure, would heartily agree, that many of the stories we hear of these kinds of encounters are dubious, to say the least. But nevertheless, the spread of the church is epic. It is unlike the spread of any institution this world has known. It's not like the spread of the British Empire. It's not like the spread of Putin's Russia. It's not like the spread of Greg's Bakery, which, even as I speak, seems to be sweeping the planet. No, it's a gathering, a bringing together, a congregation which is ordered by Christ himself and executed by the angels. The forces of heaven have gathered together this church this evening, and you cannot get more epic than that. So please, just bathe in that wonderful truth. I'm sure an atheist would think I was absolutely ridiculous for referring to the reality of angels operating in the world today. I don't have any embarrassment saying this. There are more angels out there than there are atheists. And this is wonderful news for us. The whole of heaven is in support of this kingdom of which we are part. And it's directed by the Son of Man. And we can be proud then that we are part of a kingdom which will grow and grow and grow. And every earthly kingdom will fall down and collapse and be mere dust in the wind one day. But this kingdom of which we are part this evening will last forever. Amen. Well, let's sing together hymn 285.